Chapter 14. A week later, the baker turned up unexpectedly in the yard.
"You go out, Bob," said Lentz with a poisonous look through the window. "Old pastry Casanova's sure to be wanting something for nothing."
The baker did look down in the mouth.
"Something wrong with the car?" I asked.
He shook his head.
No, running splendidly. As good as new now.
"Don't I know it?" I affirmed, eyeing him with more interest.
"Well, you see," said he, "it's this way. I rather want another car, a bigger one."
He glanced round the yard.
"Didn't I see a Cadillac last time I was here?"
I saw at once what the trouble was. The dark person he lived with had been busy needing him a bit.
"The Cadillac? Oh, yes," said I with enthusiasm. "You ought to have got in on that when you had the chance. An absolute bargain. Went for 7,000 marks. A gift, you might say."
"Well, hardly a gift."
"A gift," I repeated emphatically, considering what should be the next move.
"I can inquire, if you like," said I then. "Perhaps the chap who bought it is needing money. These things go quickly nowadays. Half a mo."
I went into the shop and quickly told what had happened. Gottfried leapt up.
"Where can we lay hands on an old Cadillac, boys? Come on, get busy."
"You leave that to me," said I. "You watch the baker doesn't escape in the meantime."
"Done."
Gottfried vanished. I rang up Blumenthal. I hadn't much hope, but one could only try. He was in his office.
"Do you want to sell your Cadillac?" I asked at once.
Blumenthal laughed.
"I've got somebody for it," I went on. "Cash down."
"Cash down," replied Blumenthal after a moment's reflection. "That's a word of purest poetry these days."
"That's my idea, too," said I, brightening suddenly.
"Then how is it? Can we talk it over?"
"One can always talk," observed Blumenthal.
"Good. When can I see you?"
"This afternoon, after lunch, I have time. Let's say around 2, in the office here."
"Right."
I hung up.
"Otto," I said rather excitedly to Koster. "I never expected it, but I believe our old Cadillac is coming back."
Koster laid aside all his papers.
"Really? Does he want to sell?"
I nodded and looked through the window to where Lentz was talking hard to the baker.
"He's making a mess of it," said I uncomfortably. "He's talking too much. That baker's a tower of suspicion. You could only persuade him by saying nothing. I must go out and relieve Gottfried at once."
Custer laughed.
"Right. Neck or nothing, Bob."
I winked at him and went. But I could hardly believe my ears. So far from singing premature hymns to the Cadillac, Gottfried was entirely engrossed in explaining to the baker how the South American Indians make their maize bread. I gave him an approving glance and then turned to the baker.
"Unfortunately, the chap doesn't want to sell."
"What did I tell you?" said Lentz promptly, as if we had already discussed it. I gave a shrug.
"It's a pity, but I can understand."
The baker stood there irresolute. I looked at Lentz.
"Well, couldn't you try him again, perhaps?" he asked immediately.
"I'm doing that in any case," I replied. "I've arranged any way to see him this afternoon. Where could I get a hold of you afterwards?" I asked the baker.
"I'll be in the neighborhood here around 4. I could look in again then."
"Good. I'll be sure to know definitely by then. I hope we do pull it off."
The baker nodded. Then he got into his Ford and steamed off.
"Are you quite godforsaken?" burst out Lentz the moment he was around the corner. "No sooner do I get a good grip on the boy than you let him go, just like that."
"Logic and psychology, my dear Gottfried," I replied, clapping him on the shoulder.
"You don't understand that sort of thing yet."
He shook off my hand.
"Psychology," said he contemptuously. "The best psychology is a good opportunity.
And that was one. The fellow will never come back.
He'll be back at 4 o'clock. Gottfried looked at me pityingly.
Will you bet? He asked.
Sure, I replied. But you'll fall in. I know the chap better than you. You must bring him several times to the fire. Besides, I can't sell him something we haven't got.
Ach du lieber Gott.
If that's all you understand, said Gottfried, shaking his head, then you'll never get anywhere, baby. That's the very first law of good business. Come now, I'll give you a free course in modern business methods. After lunch, I went to Blumenthal. On the way, I had the feeling of a young billy goat going to call on an old wolf. The sun was burning on the asphalt, and with every step I felt less desire to be turned on the spit by Blumenthal. It would be best to make short work of it.
Herr Blumenthal, said I quickly as I entered, before he could begin. A fair proposition from the start. 5,500 marks you paid for the Cadillac. I'm offering you 6. On condition I do actually dispose of it. That will be settled this evening.
Blumenthal was sitting enthroned behind his desk in the act of eating an apple. He stopped eating and looked at me a moment.
Good, said he then, and went on eating.
I waited till he threw the core into the waste paper basket.
Then you are agreeable? I asked.
Moment. He produced a fresh apple from the drawer of his desk.
Won't you have one, too?
Thanks, not just now. He bit into it.
Eat lots of apples, Herr Lohkamp.
Apples prolong life. Every day a few apples, and you never need a doctor.
Not even if you break an arm?
He grinned, threw away the second core, and stood up.
Then you wouldn't break an arm.
Sounds practical, said I, and waited for what would come next. This apple talk was suspicious to me. Blumenthal took a box of cigars from a little cupboard and offered them to me. They were the Coronas I knew of old.
Do they prolong life too? I asked.
No, they shorten it. That balances the apples. He blew out a cloud of smoke and looked at me with his head to one side like a meditative fowl, from below upward.
Balance, Herr Lohkamp. Always balance. That's the whole secret of life.
If you can.
He winked.
Quite.
To be able, that's the secret, of course. We know too much and can do too little.
Because we know too much.
He laughed.
Forgive me. After lunch, I'm always a bit philosophical.
The best time, too, said I.
Now about the Cadillac. We balance there, too, no?
He raised a hand.
1 second.
I lowered my head resignedly.
Blumenthal saw it and laughed.
Not as you think. I only meant to pay you a compliment.
Over-trumping from the start with open cards. That was well calculated for old Blumenthal. Do you know what I was expecting?
That I would begin by offering 4,500.
Exactly. But you would have fared badly. You're going to sell for 7, aren't you?
I shrugged my shoulders in a noncommittal way.
Why 7 exactly?
Because that was your first price to me.
You have a splendid memory, said I.
For figures.
Only for figures, unfortunately.
Well, to come to a conclusion, you can have the car for the price.
He held out his hand and I seized it.
Thank God for that, said I with relief. The first stroke of business for long enough.
The Cadillac seems to bring us luck.
Me too, said Blumenthal. I've made 500 on it, too, don't forget.
That's so. But tell me, why do you want to sell it again so soon, actually? Don't you like it?
Pure superstition, explained Blumenthal. I never miss a deal by which I stand to make. Fine superstition, I replied. He wagged his shining pate. You don't believe it? Well, it's right. So that nothing shall go amiss with me in other things. To neglect a deal today is to tempt Providence, and there's none of us can afford that. At 4:30, Gottfried Lenz, with a significant expression, placed an empty gin bottle on the table in front of me. I'd like you to fill it, baby, free of charge. You remember our bet. I remember, said I, but you come too soon. Without a word, Gottfried held his watch before my nose. 4:30, said I. Astronomical time, apparently. After all, anyone can be late. I'll double the bet. 2-1. Accepted, announced Gottfried cheerfully. Makes 4 bottles of gin gratis for me. That's what is called heroism in a lost cause. Honorable, baby, but mistaken. You wait. I was far from being so confident as I made out. On the contrary, I felt pretty certain now the baker would not come back. I ought to have made sure of him this morning. He was too unreliable. As the siren of the spring mattress factory opposite tooted 5, Gottfried silently placed 3 more empty gin bottles in front of me on the table. Then he leaned against the window and stared at me. I'm thirsty, said he after a while with emphasis. On that instant, I heard the unmistakable rattle of a Ford engine out on the street, and immediately after, the baker's car turned in at our entrance. If you are thirsty, my dear Gottfried, I replied with dignity, just run along and buy the 2 bottles of rum I've won with my bet. You can have a pull. Gratis. See the baker out there? Psychology, my boy. And now clear away the empty gin bottles. Then afterwards you can take out the taxi. You're too young yet for the finer work. Cheerio, my son. I went out and told the baker that the car was apparently to be had. The client was asking $7,500, but if he saw cash for it, he might come down to $7,000. The baker listened so distractedly that I stopped short. I have to ring the chap again about 6, said I finally. About 6? The baker roused out of his inattention. At 6, I have to... He turned to me suddenly. Would you come with me? Where to? I asked in amazement. To your friend, the painter. The picture is ready. Ach so, to Ferdinand Grau. He nodded. Come along, will you? Then we can discuss the car afterwards. He seemed to lay some store on not going alone. On the other hand, I also lay some store on not letting him alone again. All right, said I, therefore. It's a fair distance. We'd better set off at once. Ferdinand Grau looked ill. His face was gray-green, shadowed and puffy. He greeted us at the door of the studio. The baker hardly looked at him. He was strangely unsure of himself and excited. Where is it? He asked immediately. Ferdinand pointed with a hand to the window. The picture was leaning there on an easel. The baker walked across quickly and then stopped motionless in front of the picture. After a while, he removed his hat. He had been in such a hurry he had quite forgotten it before. Ferdinand and I remained by the door. How goes it, Ferdinand? I asked. He made a vague gesture. Something wrong? What should be wrong? You look so bad. Nothing else? No, said I. Nothing else. He put his great hand on my shoulder and smiled with an expression like an old St. Bernard's. We waited some time longer. Then we went across to the baker. I was surprised when I saw the picture. The head had come up very well, from the photo of the wedding and the second care-ridden snap of a woman still young, who gazed in front of her with grave, rather bewildered eyes.
Yes, said the baker without turning round. That is she.
He said it more to himself, and it seemed to me as if he did not even know he had said it.
Have you enough light? Asked Ferdinand.
The baker did not answer. Ferdinand went forward to turn the easel a bit. Then he walked back and nodded to me to come with him into the little room adjoining the studio.
I would never have thought it, said he, surprised.
It's got the old rebate machine on the raw. He's blubbering.
It gets everybody sometime, I replied. Only for him, it's too late.
Too late, said Ferdinand. Always too late.
It's the way with life, Bob. He walked slowly to and fro.
We'll leave him quietly a while to himself there, said he. What do you say to a game of chess in the meantime?
You are a cheerful soul, Ferdinand, said I. He stopped.
Why not? Doesn't do him any harm. Doesn't do him any good. If you were always thinking of that sort of thing, why, nobody would ever laugh again, Bob.
You're right there, said I. Then let's have a quick game. We set up the men and began. Ferdinand won without much difficulty. He mated me with rook and bishop without using the queen.
Don't know how you do it, said I. You look as if you haven't been to sleep for 3 nights, and yet you play like a pirate.
I always play well when I'm melancholy, replied Ferdinand.
Why are you melancholy?
Ugh, I don't know. Because it's getting dark. All decent people are melancholy when evening comes. Not for any particular reason, just on general grounds.
But only when they're alone, said I.
Of course. The hour of the shadows. The hour of loneliness. The hour when cognac tastes best.
He fetched a bottle and 2 glasses.
Shouldn't we go into the baker? I asked.
In a minute.
He poured out.
Prost, Bob. Because we all must die.
Prost, Ferdinand. Because we're still here.
Well, said he, it hasn't wanted much sometimes. Let's have one to that, too.
Right. We went back into the studio. It had grown darker. The baker, with hunched shoulders, was still standing before the picture. He looked pitifully lost in the great, bare room, and it struck me he had become smaller.
Shall I pack up the picture for you? Asked Ferdinand.
He gave a start of alarm.
No.
Then I'll send it tomorrow.
Can't it remain here still?
Asked the baker hesitantly.
But why?
Replied Ferdinand, astonished, and coming nearer.
Don't you like it?
Yes. But I would sooner leave it here.
I don't understand.
The baker looked at me for help. I understood. He was afraid to hang the picture at home with the black bitch. Perhaps, too, he felt a certain fear before the dead woman of taking her there.
But Ferdinand, said I, the picture can stay here, can't it, if it is paid for?
That, of course.
The baker, relieved, took his checkbook from his pocket. The 2 went to the table.
400 marks the remainder, asked the baker.
420, said Ferdinand, including discount.
Do you want a receipt?
Yes, replied the baker, for the accountants.
In silence, they wrote out the check and the receipt. I remained by the window and looked around. In the half-light of dusk, the faces of the unclaimed and unpaid for gleamed on the walls in their golden frames. They looked like a ghostly assemblage from the other world, and their steady gaze seemed turned upon the picture by the window, which was now to join them, and over which the evening was shedding its last glow. It was a queer atmosphere. The two bowed writing figures at the table, the shadows and the many silent portraits. The baker returned to the window. His bloodshot eyes looked like glass marbles. His mouth was half open. The underlip dropped so that one could see the stained teeth. It was both comic and sad the way he stood there. On the floor above the studio, someone started playing the piano. Some finger exercise or other. Always the same sequence of notes. It sounded thin and complaining. Ferdinand Grau was still standing by the table. He lit himself a cigar. The light of the match illumined his face. The half-dark room appeared monstrously large and very blue against the little red glow. "Can you still change something in the picture?" asked the baker. "What is it?" Ferdinand came forward. The baker pointed to the jewelry. "Could you take that out again?" It was the enormous gold brooch he had asked for as an extra when he ordered the picture. "Certainly," said Ferdinand. "As a matter of fact, it disturbs the face. The portrait gains if it comes out." "I think so, too." He rambled around a while. "What would it cost?" Ferdinand and I glanced at one another. "It wouldn't cost anything," said Ferdinand generously. "On the contrary, you would stand to get something back. There would be less in it then, you see." The baker lifted his head in surprise. For a moment it looked as if he meant to go into the matter, but then he said with finality, "Ach, no. Don't bother about that. After all, you did have to paint it." "That is also true." We left. On the stairs, as I saw the stooping back in front of me, I was a bit troubled about the baker and the tact that his conscience had smitten him in the middle of the swindle with the brooch. I didn't quite like going for him with the Cadillac while he was in this frame of mind. But then I reflected that part, at least, of his very laudable regret for his dead wife arose only because the black person at home was such a bitch, and I felt quite fresh again. "We can discuss the matter at my place," said he, outside. I nodded. It would suit me very well. The baker imagined, doubtless, he would be stronger within his own four walls, but I was counting on the black one for support. She was already at the door awaiting us. "Hearty congratulations," said I before the baker could open his mouth. "What for?" she asked quickly, with darting eyes. "Your Cadillac," I replied imperturbably. "Sweetheart!" With a bound, she was hanging on the baker's neck. "But we're not there yet." He attempted to free himself and make some explanation, but she held him tight and tantalizingly spun him round in circles so that he could not get a word in. Alternating, I saw over his shoulder her sly, winking face, and over her shoulder, his reproachful, vainly protesting weevil's head. At last he succeeded in freeing himself. "We are not so far by any means," he panted. "Oh, yes," said I heartily, "we are so far. I'll lay my hat I can bring him down the last 500 marks. You won't pay a pfennig more than 7,000 marks for the Cadillac. Do you agree?" "Of course," said the black one quickly. "Surely that's cheap, sweetheart." "Stop!" The baker held up his hand. "Now what is the matter with you?" She went for him. "First you say you'll get the car, and now you stand there again and say you won't."
"He will, all right," I interposed. "We've discussed it already."
"Well, sweetheart, why then?"
She leaned close against him. He tried to free himself once more, but she pressed her full breasts against his arm. He made an exasperated grimace, but his resistance was weakening.
"The Ford," said he,
"will be taken in part payment, of course."
4,000 marks?
"It cost you all that?" I asked amiably.
"It must be taken in payment for 4,000 marks," declared the baker firmly.
He had at last found the point for counterattack after the first surprise. The car's as good as new. New, said I, after that enormous repair. You admitted it yourself only this morning. This morning, it was another matter. There is new and new, according as you were buying or selling. For 4,000 marks, your Ford would need to have fenders of gold.
4,000 marks, or it's nothing, said the baker pig-headedly.
He was now his old self again, and apparently meant to make good on any recent sentimentality. Then au revoir, I replied, and turned to the black one. I'm sorry, madam, but I cannot make a losing deal. We make nothing on the Cadillac anyway, so I can't possibly take an old Ford in payment at an enormous price. Goodbye. She held me back. Her eyes flashed, and she now fell on the baker so that he did not know if he were coming or going.
You have said yourself 100 times the Ford isn't worth a thing anymore, she hissed finally with tears in her eyes.
2,000 marks, said I. 2,000 marks, though that is suicide.
The baker said nothing.
Well, come on, say something. What are you standing around there for and not opening your mouth? Spat the black one.
You will excuse me, said I. I'll just go and get the Cadillac. Perhaps you'll talk it over in the meantime between yourselves.
I had the feeling I could not do better than vanish. Darkie would follow up the business for me. An hour later, I was there with the Cadillac. I saw immediately that the quarrel had been settled in the simplest way. The baker looked a bit rumpled, and there was a bed feather hanging from his coat. The dark one, on the other hand, was flashing, breasts dancing, and she smiled, satisfied and treacherous. She had changed her dress and was now wearing a thin, clinging silk frock. In an unobserved moment, she nodded to me and winked an eye to say all was in order. We made a trial run. Darkie snuggled down comfortably into the wide seat and prattled continuously. I should have liked to throw her out of the window, but I had need of her still. The baker sat beside me rather glum. He was mourning in advance for his money, perhaps the most sincere mourning there is. We pulled up outside the baker's house and went in again. The baker left the room to get the money. He now looked like an old man, and I saw that his hair was dyed. The dark one passed her hands over her dress.
We did that pretty well, what?
Yes, said I reluctantly. That will cost you 100 marks for me.
Ach so, said I.
The stingy old buck, she whispered confidentially, coming nearer, has money to burn, but to get anything out of him. Refuses even to make a will. And afterwards, of course, everything will go to the children, and where will I be? There's no fun, either, with him always rowing.
She came still nearer and shook her breasts.
Then I'll come over tomorrow, sometime for the 100 marks. When will you be there? Or will you be passing this way? She giggled. Tomorrow afternoon. I'll be alone here.
I'll send it over to you, said I.
She giggled again. Bring it yourself. Or are you afraid?
She took me for an innocent, apparently, and meant to make quite clear to me how things stood.
Not afraid, said I, but I haven't time. I have to go see the doctor tomorrow. An old syphilis. Spoils life a bit.
She stepped back so quickly that she almost fell over a plush armchair. At that moment, the baker came in again. He looked at the dark one suspiciously. Then he counted out the money in cash on the table. He paid slowly and hesitantly. His shadow swayed on the pink carpet of the room and counted with him. As I wrote out the receipt, it struck me that this had all happened once before today. Only Ferdinand Grau had been in my place. Though it had no significance, it seemed to me queer. I was glad when I was outside again. The air was soft and summery. The Cadillac winked from the edge of the street.
Well, thanks, old boy, said I, patting the radiator. Come again soon.